And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. And also one of the most corrupt. The date is August 18th. That's the 230th day of the year. 135 days remain to this year's over with. My good friend Rich Forrest is still sitting in the hospital while the facility and the VA sit on their thumb and have another thumb in their mouth waiting for somebody to scream switch. They can't figure out what they're doing. All the while, his condition gets worse. So much for serving your country. In the year 684, Battle of Marj Rahit, Umayyad partisans defeat the supporters of the Ibn al-Zubayr and cement Umayyad control of Syria. 1304, the Battle of Mons at Pavete is fought to a draw between the French army and the Flemish militias. French had never been that hot on military tactics till Napoleon came along. 1487, the Siege of Malaga ends with the taking of the city by Castilian and Aragonese forces. 1492, the first grammar of the Spanish language. Gramática de la Lengua Castellana is presented to Queen Isabella. And students hated the person that did it after that. 1572, marriage in Paris, France, of the Huguenot King Henry III of Navarre to Margaret of Valois in a supposed attempt to reconcile Protestants and Catholics. Really did not work. 1590, John White, the governor of the Roanoke Colony. That's the second Roanoke Colony. Comes back from a surprise trip to England that only took him 2 or 3 years, and finds his settlement completely deserted. They never found anybody. 1612, the trial of the Pendle Witches, one of England's most famous witchcraft trials, begins in Lancaster Assizes. 1634, Urbain Grandier, accused and convicted of sorcery, is burned alive in Loudun, France. 1721, the city of Samokak in Safavid Shirvan is sacked. 1783, a huge fireball meteor is seen across Great Britain as it passes over the East Coast. 1826, Major Gordon Lang becomes the first non-Muslim to enter Timbuktu, which was considered a lost city for many, many years. 1838, the Wilkes expedition that explored the Puget Sound in Antarctica weighs anchor at Hampton Roads. 1848, Camilla O'Gorman and Ladislao Gutierrez are executed on the orders of Argentine dictator Juan Manuel de Rosas. 1864, American Civil War. The Battle of Globe Tavern. Union forces try to cut a vital Confederate supply line in Petersburg, Virginia by attacking the Wilmington and Weldon Railroad. I don't think they were successful. 1868, French astronomer Pierre Janssen discovers helium. 1870, Franco-Prussian War. The Battle of Gravelotte is fought. 1891, a major hurricane strikes Martinique. 700 are dead. 1903, German engineer Carl Jethro allegedly flies his self-made motored gliding airplane 4 months before the first flight of the Wright brothers. 1917, a great fire in Thessalonica in Greece destroys 32% of the city. 70,000 people are left homeless. 1920, the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution is ratified. It guarantees women's suffrage. And after that, they went on to make the men suffer. Only kidding, folks. 1923, the first British track and field championship for women takes place in London. 1938, the Thousand Islands Bridge connecting New York, the United States, with Ontario, Canada, over the St. Lawrence River is dedicated by President Franklin D. Roosevelt. 1940, World War II. The Hardest Day air battle, part of the Battle of Britain, takes place on this date. At that point, the largest aerial engagement in history with heavy losses sustained on both sides. 1945, Sukarno takes office as the first president of Indonesia. That's following the country's declaration of independence the previous day. 1950, Julian Lahaut, the chairman of the Communist Party of Belgium, is assassinated. The party newspaper blames royalist and Rexist. 1958, Vladimir Nabokov's controversial novel Lolita is published in the U.S. I've seen a cover of Lolitas in my time. Not that I've ever indulged, but I've seen them. 1958, Rohan Das from Bangladesh swims across the English Channel in a competition. He's the first Bengali and the first Asian to do so. He was first among 39 competitors. 1963, Civil Rights Movement. James Meredith becomes the first African American to graduate from University of Mississippi. Excuse me. 1965, Vietnam War. Operation Starlight begins. U.S. Marines destroy Viet Cong stronghold on Van Thuong Peninsula in the first major American ground battle of the war. And as long as the suit stayed out of it and let the military handle it, the war went fairly well. But when political and positions became more important than tactical decisions, everything went to hell in a handbasket. 1966, Vietnam War. The Battle of Long Tan ensues after a patrol from the 6th Battalion, Royal Australian Regiment, clashes with a Viet Cong force in Phuc Thuy Province. 1971, Vietnam War. Australia and New Zealand decide to withdraw their troops from Vietnam. 1976, the Korean axe murder incident in Panmunjom results in the deaths of two U.S. Army officers. Now, for those that are not familiar with it, and I had not heard of it before this, it was the killing of two Army officers, Captain Arthur Boniface and First Lieutenant Mark Barrett, by North Korean soldiers August 18, 1976. It happened in the joint security area in the Korean demilitarized zone. The U.S. Army officers had been part of a work party cutting down a poplar tree in the joint security area. 3 days later, American and South Korean forces launched Operation Paul Bunyan, an operation to cut down the tree with a show of force to intimidate North Korea into backing down. And that did occur. And North Korea then accepted responsibility for the earlier killings. Now, while the captain and the lieutenant were overseeing the removal of a 100-foot poplar tree that blocked the line of sight between a United Nations command checkpoint and an observation post needed to be removed. It was right near the bridge of no return. Checkpoint 3, next to the bridge, was the northernmost United Nations command checkpoint, visible from the observation post number 5 only during the winter months. During the summer months, only the top of Command Post 3 was visible from one other UNC checkpoint, and that was number 2. Running across the middle of the bridge was the military demarcation line between North Korea and South Korea. Well, on one occasion before the incident, North Korean soldiers held a group of U.S. troops at gunpoint. Joint Security Force Company Commander Captain Arthur Boniface bring the Americans back to safety, and he did it successfully. He'd be one of the two soldiers killed in the axe murders. The North Koreans claimed that the tree in question had been planted by their leader, Kim Il-sung, the father of the current leader of North Korea. Well, the two officers did not wear sidearms, as members of the joint security area were limited to 5 armed officers and 30 armed enlisted personnel at any given time. As they began to trim the tree, about 15 North Korean soldiers appeared, commanded by Senior Lieutenant Pak Chul, who United Nations Command soldiers nicknamed Lieutenant Bulldog because of a history he had of confrontations. These 15 North Korean soldiers attacked and killed the lieutenant and the captain. Well, 1977, Steve Bilko was arrested at a police roadblock under Terrorism Act No. 83, 1977. 1967 at King Williamstown in South Africa. He later dies from injuries sustained during his arrest, which brought the attention of the situation in South Africa's apartheid policies. 1983, Hurricane Alicia hits the Texas coast, kills 21, and causes over $1 billion in damage in 1983 dollars. 1989, leading presidential hopeful Luis Carlos Galan is assassinated near Bogota in Colombia. 2003, one-year-old Zachary Turner is murdered in Newfoundland by his mother. He was awarded custody despite facing trial for the murder of Zachary's father. You gotta wonder about that judge. The case was documented in the film Dear Zachary and led to the reform of Canada's bail laws. 2005, a massive power blackout hits the Indonesian island of Java. Affects almost 100 million people. One of the largest and most widespread power outages in history. 2008, President of Pakistan, Pervez Musharraf, resigns in the threat of impeachment. Never heard that before. 2008, war in Afghanistan. Uzban Valley ambush occurs. Now, that particular ambush was French International Security Assistance Force troops were ambushed by Afghan Taliban insurgents. There were heavy casualties. It took place in the Uzban Valley outside the village of Spirkunde. NATO report of the incident surmises surviving members of the coalition forces lucky to escape, arguing they were poorly equipped, ill-organized, and faced a well-prepared enemy. But, of course, the French government denied that. Later reports said that until then, the relative calm of the region had only been obtained by a bribery of which the French were unaware. Yeah, right. When politicians speak, how do you know they're lying? Their lips are moving. 2017, the first terrorist attack ever sentenced as a crime in Finland, killed 2 and injured 8. 2019, 100 activists, officials, other concerned citizens in Iceland held a funeral for Ojukul Glacier, completely melted after once covering 6 square miles. I tend to think folks are overreacting in this particular instance. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances. Christian feast day. Agapitus of Palestrina. Alberto Hurtado, Dog of Inniskeen. Evan. Fiacra. Floris and Loras. Helena of Constantinople in the Roman Catholic Church. William Porcher Dubose in the Dubois, perhaps, in the Episcopal Church. Arbor Day in Pakistan. Armed Forces Day in Macedonia. Birthday of Virginia Dare on Roanoke Island. She was the granddaughter of John White, the governor. He never saw her after that. Constitution Day in Indonesia. Long Tan Day, also called Vietnam Veterans Day in Australia. And in Thailand, it's National Science Day. Let's see what else we might have. In 293 BC, the oldest known Roman temple to Venus is founded, starting the institution of Vinalia Rustica. That's the grape harvest festival. In 440, St. Sixtus III ends his reign as Catholic Pope. 1201, the city of Riga is founded. 1217, first historical record of Scottish scholar Michael Scott signs and dates his translation of Albert Ruiz on the Spear in Toledo, Spain. 1289, Pope Nicholas IV publishes the decree Supramundum. 1418, competition announced to design the dome for Florentine Cathedral. Main competitors were Lorenzo Ghiberti and Filippo Brunassai, supported by Cosimo de Medici. Cosimo de Medici was the ruler and the arch patron. 1541, a Portuguese ship drifts ashore in the ancient Japanese province of Higo. That's modern day Kumamoto Prefecture. 1564, Spanish King Philip II joins the Council of Trent. He was a very powerful king. If he gave his support to something, it went. In 1605, a Spanish army under General Spinola conquers Lingen. In 1636, the covenant of the town of Dedham, Massachusetts is signed. 1686, Giovanni Cassini reports seeing a satellite orbiting Venus. 1698, Russian Tsar Peter the Great arrives in Zandam. 1700, Swedish, English, and Dutch army lands on Seeland in Denmark. 1735, the Evening Post begins publishing in Boston, Massachusetts. 1737, the first public admittance to the Salon de Paris art exhibition in Louvre in Paris was on this date. 1769, a lightning strike on the Bastion of San Nero in Brescia, Italy, ignites 90 tons of gunpowder. 3,000 people are killed. 1795, Curaco Governor De Vere sends the militia in to stop rebellious slaves. 1817, a 60 to 70 foot sea serpent sighted offshore in Gloucester, Massachusetts. 1835, the last Potawatomi Indians leave Chicago. 1840, the American Society of Dental Surgeons is founded in New York. 1840, a French colony is established in Aotearoa, South Island of New Zealand. 1846, General Stephen Kearny's U.S. forces capture Santa Fe, New Mexico, and then did not know what to do with it. 1848, I've already done that one. 1858, Netherlands and Japan sign a trade agreement. 1862, General Lee's Adjutant Major Stuart is captured by the Union. 1862, the Sioux began an uprising in Minnesota that was later crushed. They figured if the army is busy with the Confederates, they got a good chance. Didn't work. 1864, the sixth day of the battle at Deep Bottom Run in Virginia. 1864, the Battle of Petersburg. This was the first day of the Battle of Weldon Railroad. It was a three-day battle. 1870, nope, did that one. 1872, the first mail order catalog is issued by A.M. Ward. You know, at one point in time, especially in Arkansas, you weren't considered to be a member of society if you didn't have a Sears and Roebuck catalog in your outhouse. Just make sure you avoid the slick pages. They cut. 1873, the first ascent of Mount Whitney in California is 14,494 feet. 1886, Carr Baker Neal and Samuel Neal win the U.S. Lawn Tennis Association doubles. 1894, U.S. Congress creates the Bureau of Immigration. 1896, Adolph Ox, who's 39, buys the New York Times. 1909, the mayor of Tokyo, Yukio Ozaki, presented Washington, D.C. with 2,000 cherry trees, which President Taft decides to plant near the Potomac River. 1914, the Belgian army withdraws to Antwerp. 1914, French troops under General Dubail occupy Cherbourg. And in the face of coming war, President Woodrow Wilson on this date in 1914 issued a proclamation of neutrality, which meant both sides got to shoot at us. 1917, the Dutch Naval Air Force is formed. In 1917, the Queen's Hospital opens to provide pioneering plastic surgery for World War I soldiers. It's led by Harold Gillies in Sidcup in England. He's considered the modern father of modern plastic surgery. 1919, the Anti-Cigarette League of America is formed in Chicago. 1920, a 22-year-old representative named Harry T. Byrne is the deciding vote in Tennessee's and thus America's ratification of the 19th Amendment to the Constitution. That allowed women's suffrage, and he said he voted that way in favor of it after he got a letter from his mother. She told him how to vote. 1924, France begins withdrawing troops from the Ruhr. 1925, Cardinal Mercier warns Belgians against socialism and liberalism. Wish he'd have warned us. And FDR dedicates Thousand Islands Bridge connecting U.S. and Canada. 1941, the German concentration camp Amersfoort opens. And in 1942, Carlson's raiders land on Mekin in the Gilbert Islands. In the ensuing uproar, they killed 350 Japanese soldiers. Well, on that note, we've come to the end of this show. I mean, of this history section. We're going to talk about Area 51 and some of the secrets there. You know, there's a lot of doubt about many of the stories that came out of almost any place related to UFOs. But in 1978, there was a research paper titled Retrievals of the Third Kind presented at the annual Mutual UFO Network Symposium. It was done by former intelligence officer Leonard Stringfield. And it related to a story of a UFO researcher named Charles Willem, whose father heard an account by a certain Major Daly about Daly's flight to the site of a UFO crash in April of 1953. Daly described how he was blindfolded and driven out to a desert location. Once the blindfold was removed, he was shown an undamaged metallic craft close to 30 feet in diameter. Now, this is the same craft described by Stansel in his interviews. Granted, the date wasn't the same, but Stringfield, a dedicated collector of crashed UFO stories, suggested there was a connection to the Stansel revelations. Now, there's been a lot of stories about UFO crashes. In fact, we did an entire season for our new series, Beyond Roswell. And one of the things we talked about was the Kingman, Arizona case. Now, Stringfield also had the testimony of a third source who claimed knowledge about two UFO crashes in Arizona in 1953. Unfortunately, Stringfield passed away before he could reveal all the information. On December 3rd, 2006, Arthur Stansel, who was the one that blew the lid off of Kingman, died at the Good Shepherd Healthcare Facility in Jaffrey, New Hampshire. So he took to the grave whatever he knew about the Kingman incident. 1990, a UFO investigator by the name of Don, Don't You Know I'm Wonderful Smith, who'd written or co-written several repetitive books on the Roswell controversy, spoke with a woman named Judy Walcott, who had a tale of her own to tell about the Kingman crash. Her story centered on a letter that she got in 1965 from her husband, who she said was serving in Vietnam at that time. Now, in that letter, her husband said he thought he might not be returning home alive. He also told her about something strange he had seen 12 years before. And she couldn't be absolutely certain about the month, but she was positive her husband mentioned Kingman, Arizona as the location. At that time, he was a military officer, was on duty when an unidentified flying object was picked up on radar. It began to lose altitude, she said, and summarily vanished from a radar screen. Well, the husband, she said, felt that something had crashed, adding to the casualties of the extraterrestrial kind that apparently did occur. She further claimed that her husband's fears had proved to be correct. He never did come home from Vietnam. Now, the tale Judy Walcott told had the potential to take the Kingman case to a whole new level. After all, this was an outside source with no ties whatsoever to Arthur Stansel, speaking on the record about a crashed UFO in 53 and in the vicinity of Kingman, Arizona, no less. Unfortunately, there were issues with her story as well. Midway through 2010, Kevin Randall, UFO investigator, revealed his findings on the now-deceased Walcott's claims, and those findings cast a degree of doubt on the Kingman story. Randall said her tale absolutely collapsed when it was investigated. He said no husband could be found to have been killed in Vietnam, and even Walcott's own daughter, Catherine Bay, has admitted it was her mother who was prone to embellishing things and sensationalizing stories and certain aspects of her personal life. So, in the face of that, her particular story was disregarded. Now, one of the most intriguing figures to surface in this affair was a man named Bill Uhouse, a retired mechanical engineer from Las Vegas. He claimed to have worked on classified projects at certain governmental locations in Nevada that focused on reverse engineering recovered UFO technology. And UFO investigator Norio Hayakawa says of Uhouse, conspiracy theorists cite testimonies by several whistleblowers as proof of ongoing work at Area 51 to reverse engineer alien propulsion technology. And one of those whistleblowers was Bill Uhouse, a man in his 70s who claimed he worked from 66 through 79 as an engineer at the top secret Area 51 facility in collaboration with an actual gray alien. According to Uhouse, who died in 2009, he worked as a mechanical engineer at Area 51, and his companion was a gray alien known as J-Rod. Now, you have to admit, Uhouse's story is strange, and much of it is beyond the scope of the Kingman story. But UFO researcher Bill Hamilton, who I have known for a while, dug deep into the realm claims of Uhouse, who also asserted no fewer than four alien entities have been found alongside the Kingman UFO, and all of them had survived the crash, although with some degree of injury. Ominously, Uhouse also asserted several members of the team involved in the retrieval were later afflicted by what was suspected to be an unknown biological agent, thought to be possibly a dangerous alien virus. 2006, new and provocative data surfaced regarding that statement from an unnamed source who claimed a background within the U.S. Intelligence Agency. If you want to see the story this individual told, go to www.serpo.org. According to the information on that website, the Kingman crash did indeed occur, and just as Bill Uhouse claimed, four aliens had been found at the site. Two were severely injured and two in reasonably good condition. And a member of the military retrieval team, a number of the military retrieval team members suffered adverse physical effects by the exposure to both the craft and the bodies. Now, Uhouse died in 2009, but back in the early 2000s, he prepared a statement made public and for open consumption regarding his involvement in the Kingman affair and its ties to Area 51. Now, that statement said, I spent 10 years in the Marine Corps and 4 years working with the Air Force as a civilian doing experimental testing on aircraft since my Marine Corps days. He said, I was a pilot in the service and a fighter pilot.
fought in after the latter part of World War II in the Korean War conflict. Discharged as a captain in the Marine Corps. I didn't start working on flight simulators until about 1954. After I got out of the Marine Corps, I took a job with the Air Force at Wright-Patterson doing experimental flight testing on various different modifications of aircraft. He said, while I was at Wright-Patterson, I was approached by an individual whose name was not given to determine if I wanted to work at an area on new creative devices. And those new creative devices were flying saucer simulators. What they had done, they had selected several folks had been watching and reassigned them to A-Link Aviation, which was a simulator manufacturer. And at that time, they were building what they called the C-11B and the F-102 simulator, B-47 simulator, and a number of others. They wanted those they selected to get experience before they actually started working on the flying disc simulator. He said he spent 30-some years working on it. He didn't think any flying disc simulator went into operation until the early 60s, 62 or 3. And the reason because simulator wasn't actually functioning until around 1958. The simulator they used was for the extraterrestrial craft they had, which was a 30-meter one that crashed in Kingman, Arizona back in 52 or 53. That's the first one they took out on a test flight. Now, this particular craft was a control craft that the aliens wanted to present to our government. Landed about 15 miles from what used to be an Army air base, which is now defunct. But that particular craft, and there were problems with it. Number one, getting it on the flatbed to take it to Area 51. They couldn't get it across the dam because of the road had to be barged across the Colorado River at the time and taken up Route 93 out to Area 51, which was just being constructed at that point in time. Now, there were four aliens on aboard the craft, and those aliens went to Los Alamos for testing. Now, they set up Los Alamos with a particular area for these guys, and they put certain people in there with them, astrophysicists and general scientists. Their job was to ask them questions. The way they told the story, there's only one alien who would talk to any of the scientists they put in the lab with them. The rest wouldn't talk to anybody. Wouldn't even have a conversation with them. First, they thought it was all ESP or telepathy, but most of it's kind of a joke because they can speak. Maybe not like we do, but they actually speak and converse. But there was only one who would talk to the scientist. The difference between this disc and the other disc, as they looked at, was that this one had a much simpler design. Now, the disc simulator didn't have a reactor, but they had a space in it that looked like the reactor that wasn't a device that they operated the simulator with. They operated it with six large capacitors that were charged with 1,000,000 volts each, so there was 6,000,000 volts in those capacitors. In fact, he thought they were the largest capacitors ever built. And these particular capacitors would last for 30 minutes, so you could get in there, actually work the controls, and do what you had to get the simulator or the disc to operate. So it wasn't that simple because they only had 30 minutes. But in the simulator, you notice there are no seat belts. Well, the reason for that was that the actual craft didn't have any seat belts. You don't need seat belts because when you fly one of those things upside down, there's no upside down inside of, like in a regular aircraft, you just don't feel it. And he said there's a simple explanation for that. You got your own gravitational field right inside the craft, so you're flying upside down. But to you, you're flying right side up. It's just really simple. Now, he said there weren't any windows. The only way they had any visibility at all was done with the cameras or video-type devices. His specialty was the flight deck and the instruments on the flight deck. He knew about the gravitational field, and when it took to get the folks trained, because the disc had its own gravitational field, you could be sick or disoriented for about 2 minutes after getting in, after it was cranked up. It does take a lot of time to get used to it because of the area and the smallness of it. Just to raise your hand becomes complicated. You have to be trained with your mind to accept what you're going to actually feel and experience. Just moving about, it's difficult, but after a while you get used to it and you just do it. You just have to know where everything is and you have to understand what's going to happen to your body. It's no different than accepting G-forces when you're flying an aircraft or coming out of a dive. It's a whole new ball game. Now, each engineer had to do one more thing. Each engineer that had anything to do with the design was part of the startup crew. They'd have to verify all the equipment that they put in. And he was sure the crews have taken these craft out into space. It probably took a while to train enough of the people over a sufficient period of time, but the whole problem with the disc is that it's so exacting in its design. Can't be used like we use aircraft today with dropping bombs and having machine guns in the wings. The design is so specific and exact, you can't add anything. It's got to be just right. And there's a big problem with the design of these things, of where things are put. For example, where the center of the aircraft is and that type of thing. Even the fact that they raised it 3 feet so the taller guys could get in, the actual ship was extended back to its original configuration. But it has to be raised. They had meetings. They ended up in a meeting with an alien. He called him J-Rod, of course. He didn't know if that was his real name or not, but that's the name the linguist gave him. Now, the guy who gave the statement drew a sketch before he left of him in a meeting, and he provided it to some people, and that was his impression of what he saw. An art picture of an alien that's working in cooperation with Earth people, as he said. Bill Uhouse's strange and controversial story ends there. Now, just like Bob Lazar, he had his believers as well as those who concluded his story as pure garbage or perhaps government disinformation. Now there's a man by the name of Truman Bethurum whose testimony relative to UFOs extends more than half a century into the past, but whose relevance to Kingman only became apparent in the early 2009. Beyond any shadow of a doubt, the number of people who can claim the aliens wrecked their marriage is infinitely small, but these claims have been made, the most memorable being that of the construction worker Bethurum. His idea of a close encounter was apparently quite different than those of other UFO witnesses and abductees. He alleged his 1952 liaisons atop Nevada's Mount Mesa with UFO Captain Ora Raines, said to be a citizen of the planet Clarion, ultimately led his outraged wife to file for divorce. Now, it has to be stressed, his story that he had an alleged affair. Now, Mormon Mesa is an 1,893-foot-high summit that dominates Nevada's Moapa Valley. Between the mesa and its two near-identical neighbors are two huge chasms created by the muddy and virgin rivers which carved the mesas eons ago. The visually stunning Mormon Mesa is about to become a hotbed of alien activity. You see, in the latter half of 1952, Bethurum was contracted to do some work in that area. Because the area had been covered by ocean during prehistoric times, after he finished his shift one particular night, he headed out to the mesa to see if he could find any fossilized shells as a gift for his wife, who was an avid collector of seashells. She had decided not to accompany her husband in Nevada and instead elected to remain in her home back in Santa Barbara. So Bethurum had all this time on his hand, and he searched in virtual darkness for a couple of hours, but didn't find anything, so went back to his truck to get some sleep. Well, as while he was snoozing, or maybe in an altered state of consciousness, Bethurum was visited by inhabitants of another world, the Clarionites. An hour or so after falling asleep, according to him, he was awakened by what he described as mumbling. As it began to stir, he was shocked to see his truck was surrounded by 8 to 10 men, all olive skin, about 5 feet tall, wearing uniforms and black baseball caps. Well, he said they were soon joined by a beautiful woman. The captain of the alien craft, who introduced herself as Ora Raines. Well, Bethurum said he was instantly smitten. The pair spoke at length about politics and history and the dangers posed to the human race and the planet itself by atomic weapons. A few hours later, Captain Raines and her crew were gone, but not for long. Overall, Bethurum claimed to have had close to a dozen meetings with this gorgeous space woman. And the liaisons got more and more flirty as time went on. On the night of November 2nd, 1952, he was out in the desert, very near to the town of Kingman. He was anxious to see his gorgeous Captain Raines again, so he fired into the air one of several flares, supposedly given to him by his alien friends as a means of contacting him at any time. Sure enough, she and her crew arrived on the scene very quickly. And for what was to be the final time, he was invited aboard the saucer, and the pair chatted at length about life on their respective worlds, their hobbies, and a much more of a friendly nature. Well, she escorted Beth the room out of the saucer and back to the desert floor, where they bid one another farewell. A few moments, Beth the room was alone, standing in the dark desert and watching in awe as the large alien craft rose silently into the air. Now, it has to be said at this juncture that much of his story is frankly unbelievable. His description of his encounters with the sexy Captain Range is something like a cross between Star Trek and Baywatch or a wild science fiction novel. Be easy to regulate his story to the realm of fiction and nothing else. Certainly a lot of folks within the UFO research community have done that without any hesitation. Despite this, though, one particularly intriguing aspect of his otherwise fantastic story may have a bearing on the story of Arthur Stancil. That may even suggest that Betharoom wasn't quite the fantasist that so many people believe him to be. When Arthur Stancil described the alien body he found at Kingman in his 1973 affidavit, he stated it was about 4 feet tall, dark brown in complexion, and had two eyes, two nose, two nostrils, two ears, and a small round mouth. Also clothed in a silvery metallic suit and wore a skull cap of the same type of material. Now compare that with what the aliens Betharoom claimed to have encountered in the late 1952, just a few months earlier, very near Kingman, olive skin, 5 feet in height, wearing uniforms and black caps. Now the location, though, the Kingman region is the same in both stories. In fact, one of Betharoom's encounters occurred right on the fringes of Kingman, and the aliens in both accounts were short in stature. Both Stancil and Betharoom said the aliens wore uniforms and caps. As well, the body Stancil saw had dark skin, and Betharoom's aliens had olive skin. Betharoom's encounters took place in 1952. The crash took place in 1953. The similarities between the two accounts are strikingly similar. The wholly skeptical commenter might say that Betharoom simply made up his story after hearing of Stancil's revelations in the 70s. But this particular story has one insurmountable problem. Betharoom's account was published in 1954, less than 1 year after the alleged events at Kingman occurred, nearly 2 decades before Arthur Kingman even told his story to Jeff Young and Paul Chatham. So at this point, you have to wonder if maybe Betharoom was not the hoaxer a lot of folks thought he was. But at this late date, all we can say with some certainty is that we have one controversial case, the Kingman affair, that seems to be somewhat corroborated by a highly emotive UFO story. But the Betharoom saga. Well, now we got another story that takes the Kingman case in a completely different direction. U.S. Air Force files demonstrate that in the same precise time frame of the Kingman crash, specifically during the Atomic Energy Commission's Operation Upshot Knothole test that Arthur Stancil played a role in on the Nevada test and training range, the military was secretly test-flying drone aircraft in the Nevada-Arizona area with monkeys on board. Many of those monkeys went on to become members of Congress. While the image of an unmanned drone aircraft packed with a crew of monkeys flying around the desert of the Southwest might sound bizarre in the extreme, official papers established that such tests were indeed undertaken. They were released into the public domain via the Freedom of Information Act and are housed at the National Archives in Maryland. They can be reviewed and studied by the general public and historians. Now, one document titled Early Cloud Penetration is dated January 27, 1956. It's prepared by the Air Research and Development Command at Kirtland Air Force Base in New Mexico. And it reads in part, in the event of nuclear warfare, the Air Force is confronted with two special problems. First is the hazard to flight crews and may be forced to fly through an atomic cloud. Second is the hazard to ground crews who maintain the aircraft after it's flown through the cloud. In 1953 Upshot Knothole test, monkeys were used so that the experiments could go conducted on large animals near to the size of man. QF-80 drone aircraft were used, and their speed were more nearly approximated that of the current operational aircraft. The QF-80 aircraft was actually a modified Air Force P-80 Shooting Star aircraft that had been converted to drone status through an operation known as Project Bad Boy, which came under the jurisdiction of a contractor called Perry Gyroscopes. And that's not all. The document states the monkeys on board the craft were dressed in various types of protective clothing and wore skull caps. Closer match to Stansel's admittedly alcohol-fueled Nibella's description of the creature he saw would be very difficult to find. So, what do we think about this curious story? Got initial testimony from a military source that seems credible, but which was subsequently thrown in a significant degree of doubt when it was revealed that Stansel changed his story and exaggerated the facts after having imbibed his favorite beverages of the boozy kind. Of course, all this means we really have no choice but to look at the whole thing with a firm degree of caution. However, the additional data on the Kingman story still suggests Stansel should be given the benefit of the doubt. So what about the bizarre story of Truman Bethurum and his sexy alien captain? In retrospect, it does seem to fit in with certain salient points in the Stansel revelations, but the fact that Bethurum firmly stuck to such a bizarre tale of ethereal dalliances with a hot babe from the stars only adds even more controversy to the story. Well, the question has to be asked here is, what do we think about all this? Now, for a significant period of time, a lot of researchers believe a UFO of extraterrestrial origins crashed near Kingman, Arizona in May of 1953. When I did the research for Beyond Roswell, everything I found pointed to it being a legitimate UFO. Some researchers are less inclined to think that now and more inclined to believe that the object found in Kingman was indeed one of the secret drone aircraft flown through the ominous mushroom clouds born out of Operation Upshot Knothole in Nevada. You need to recall that Stansel was informed by his superiors the Kingman craft was a secret experimental vehicle of the U.S. military. Although this assertion was complicated by Stansel's later claim, this is merely a cover story to hide the fact this was a UFO crash. Moreover, during the course of his interview with Young and Cheatham, Stansel described the vehicle as being barely 12 feet long, metallic aluminum in color and appearance, and teardrop of cigar shape. Now, the resemblance of this description to a piece of fuselage of one of the QF-80 aircraft utilized in the Nevada test and training range-based Operation Upshot Knothole monkey flights really can't be ignored. You only have to take a look at a photograph of one of these aircraft to get a sense of the resemblance. And finally, is it really feasible a UFO piloted by a small alien entity should happen to have crashed in the same location within the same time frame the secret Air Force aircraft with a number of small primates on board are flying around? That does stretch credibility. That being said, even though the Kingman UFO tale seems to have been born out of exaggeration of a real but wholly down-to-earth event, it's been largely amplified by unnamed whistleblowers of the type that contacted Leonard Stringfield in the late 70s and early 80s. So really, you can't discount the story. When I did the research for Beyond Roswell, I found a lot of confirmation that this was a crash. We should always strive to be grounded, methodical, and logical in our pursuits of UFOs. We should avoid falling into the trap of wanting to believe that the Kingman crash had alien or military origins. I mean, after all, this kind of bias is a huge impediment in getting to the truth of any matter. And then when you throw in Mr. I'm a UFO God, Don Smith, you don't really know what's true and what's not. Well, as we've seen, most agencies of the government are extremely reticent to even mention the word Area 51. Never mind comment on its existence. But that's certainly not the case with the CIA. At least in this day and time. Now, at one time, the agency was in accord with other official bodies not to talk about Area 51. Of course, that's all changed now, particularly so with regard to the issues that have surfaced with Area 51 in the history and development of the legendary U-2 spy plane, which was actually secretly tested at that base.
All right, we were talking about the U-2. In fact, the CIA has seen fit to place into the public domain a lot of information prepared by CIA employees. And they did it for the benefit of the media, employees, the public, and aviation historians.
So you have to wonder what the other agencies might think about all this. According to the CIA, on August 1st, 1955, during a high-speed taxi test of the first U-2, Lockheed's chief test pilot, Tony LeVere, inadvertently became airborne at a remote test site in a desert in western Nevada, called Nevada Test and Training Range at Groom Lake. You might know that as Area 51. Now, LeVere, who had conducted the first taxi test a few days prior, accelerated U-2 to 70 knots when he suddenly realized he was airborne. That wasn't supposed to happen. In the CIA and the overhead reconnaissance, the U-2 and the Oxcart program from 1954 to 1974, a lot of more information was given. Now, this document was written by CIA historians. According to LeVere, I immediately started back toward the ground, but had difficulty determining my height because the lake bed had no markings to judge distance or height. I made contact with the ground on the left bank of approximately 10 degrees. Now, the CIA also noted that LeVere was unable to land the U-2 in his first attempt. It bounced back into the air, but he managed to successfully bring it down on a second try. Now, damage to the prototype was very minor, according to LeVere. The test would later be considered the first unofficial flight of the U-2. Later on, a few days later, on August 4th, LeVere actually piloted the U-2's first official test flight. In the first official flight, when visiting dignitaries present, was on August 8th. Further evidence of the way in which the CIA is opening up on the work undertaken in Area 51 is shown by the following statement. Much of the testing took place at the facility at Groom Lake, a dry lake bed near Las Vegas, Nevada. It's in an isolated area that came to be known as Area 51 in Watertown. Area was chosen by top officials of the U-2's development project staff who flew to Nevada in search of a site where the U-2 could be tested safely and secretly. They spotted what appeared to be an airstrip by a salt flat, that's Groom Lake, and that was near the northeast corner of the Atomic Energy Commission's Nevada Proving Ground. It had been used during World War II as an aerial gunnery range for Army pilots. It was decided the site was perfect for testing the U-2 and training its pilots. However, when further discovered, the U-2 project staff learned that Groom Lake was not actually part of the AEC Proving Ground. So they asked the Atomic Energy Commission to add the Groom Lake Strip to its real estate holdings in Nevada, which the AEC readily agreed to do, and Eisenhower approved the deal, and the land was stolen. CIA's revealed a lot more, much of it relative to the early years of Area 51, its origin, and how it became a hotbed for secret aircraft-based testing and technology. They said to make the new facility sound more attractive to the pilots and workers who would reside there, Lockheed's famous aeronautical engineer, Clarence Kelly Johnson, called it Paradise Ranch, which was soon shortened to just the nickname Ranch. Many of the workers even refer to themselves as ranch hands. Area 51 is also known by the nickname of Watertown, which was rumored to have been inspired by the name of CIA Director Alan Dulles' birthplace of Watertown, New York. Records show the name was a reference to when the rainwater would run off the nearby mountains and flood the dry lake bed of Groom Lake. However, when the lake bed flooded, project managers referred to the facility as Watertown Strip. The name Dreamland was also commonly associated with the Groom Lake facility. According to Thornton Barnes, president of Roadrunners International, an association of former Air Force, CIA, and contract personnel serving at Area 51 during the Cold War, Dreamland was a radio call sign for the base introduced in the late 60s. It replaced the previous call sign of Yuletide and referred specifically to the large block of airspace called a Special Operations Area surrounding Area 51 in parts of the Nevada test site and the Nellis Air Force Range. While the commonly preferred official name for the facility today is the Nevada Test and Training Range at Groom Lake, both the names Watertown and Area 51 are used as official names for the facility. According to Barnes, Area 51 may be found on official Nevada test site maps and other documentation, while some Department of Energy documents indicate that Watertown is legally listed as a member of Alamo Township in Lincoln County, Nevada. For security reasons, primary access to Area 51 is by aircraft. There is a road running in there, and there is a mailbox. It was purchased at great expense and taken on a world tour. A C-124 would transport the components of a U-2, which were constructed in Burbank, California, and then disassembled and transported to Watertown for reassembly and testing. A daily air shuttle also transported personnel and other cargo between Watertown and the Skunk Works. That's the Lockheed production facility in Burbank. Then the CIA went on to say something that everybody considers rather important. The U-2 wasn't the only agency aircraft transported and tested and flown out of Area 51. The first flight test of the CIA's A-12 Oxcart took place at the Groom Lake facility April 25, 1962. The remaining operational aircraft arrived for flight tests through mid-1964. By the fall of 1965, the 11 pilots selected to fly A-12 missions and their aircraft are ready for deployment. CIA, Air Force, and private industry personnel from many specialties helped make the U-2 a reality, and several died in the process. Four of those were pilots who had known the risk of handling an aircraft that was difficult to fly, even in the best of circumstances. 14 members involved in the U-2 project also lost their lives when their transport plane crashed en route from Burbank to Watertown. There was bad weather when they flew out. And they crashed into Mount Charleston, a few miles outside of Las Vegas. The sacrifice those pilots and U-2 project personnel made for their country helped the U.S. win the Cold War, such as it could be won. Along with the thousands of Americans who worked at Area 51, their patriotism, ingenuity, and willingness to take on a project critics believed was impossible at the time, and they're referring to the creation of the U-2, allowed the U.S. to penetrate the Iron Curtain and gain an unparalleled advantage over the Soviets in intelligence gathering. As for the A-12 Oxcart program, the CIA is now extremely open on the matter of those early years at Area 51. It's most refreshing to get that attitude out of the CIA. From CIA documents, we see the CIA developed a highly secret A-12 Oxcart as the U-2 spy plane's successor, intended to meet the nation's need for a very fast, very high-flying reconnaissance aircraft that could avoid Soviet air defenses. Came operational November 12, 1965. Not only did the A-12 prove its worth during its short operational life, but the overall Oxcart project produced the second longest-lasting aerial reconnaissance platform in U.S. history, the SR-71. And according to CIA, the SR-71 Blackbird was the Air Force's two-seat follow-on version to Oxcart. In fact, the A-12 Oxcart's unique design and characteristics became the foundation for three other versions of the supersonic aircraft that Lockheed built for the CIA: the YF-12A, the M-21, and of course, the SR-71. Well, on this note, we run out of time for tonight's show. We're going to keep talking about some of the mysteries of Area 51. But for right now, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.